Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network, and I am joined on this fine Thursday morning by Tracy Pearson. Tracy, how are you?
I'm just okay, Dave.
You're just okay?
Yeah, it's not earwax now. It's now grinding and clenching. Grinding. If anyone out there, a lot of the population does this, it's a bitch, man. I know you all are out there and you all got your mouth guards and stuff, but yeah. I just want to say
I'm for everyone out there who's wondering, grinding and clenching teeth. Tracy's not working on his kegels these days.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, got a kegels reference in there, and we're 45 right now. Seconds in. Yeah, teeth pain, one of the worst types of pain.
Worst.
Absolutely. I had I had to get a root canal for, I think, there was something going on, like an abscess tooth or something when I was in college. Worst pain of my entire life.
Yeah.
Awful.
Yeah. Awful. If it's a tooth issue, something like, and it resonates in the most immediate muscles, then it just keeps going. And all these other muscles around your head, down your neck, it's just, wow.
Well, and it's one of the weird pains where it radiates, where you're actually sure how to locate it, because it'll hurt on one side of your mouth. And it's like, oh no, the thing that's wrong is over here.
Yeah. And usually whenever I'm in pain, you know, I go right to the heavy drugs. Mm. Which is alcohol. I mean, alcohol works for me.
Oh, I thought you were going cocaine, but yeah, sure.
No, actually, alcohol is, you know, I've done oxycodone and alcohol works better. Alcohol is better. They should prescribe it. Doctors should write a prescription.
This is not a lifestyle guide. You know.
All right. Anyway, okay, it just works for me, Dave. I got a prescription for my doctor to drink. Basil Hayden every night.
Booze. Well, we've got a lot to talk about today. As everyone knows, UCLA men's basketball had a road trip from hell. Went to Michigan, lost by 30, went to Michigan State, and despite losing by 23, I think it was a worse game with worse effort and obviously a bunch of embarrassing stuff. Let me set the stage a little bit for those who didn't watch the game, just so we all know what we're talking about. So Michigan game was very bad. They lost by 30, but it was competitive at halftime. And then they just got absolutely smoked off the floor in the second half. It was a big blowout, one of the worst blowouts of the Cronin era, but it wasn't. It was embarrassing in that, why are they this much worse than Michigan? But it wasn't like there was a, you know, an inciting incident that was like, oh, this is, wow, what's going on?
And a subhead and a continuing theme, why aren't they playing hard?
Correct. Then the Michigan State game happened, and UCLA was completely like not trying hard from about 5 minutes into the game the whole way. They weren't focused. It was really, really bad effort, really bad intensity. They gave up a ton of threes in the first half, and then the first four possessions for Michigan State coming out of halftime, they gave them quite literally wide open three-point shots, like wide open, and not even
like the kind of, if you're watching on TV, you can't see anyone else on the screen.
Correct. It was like you don't know how that gets wide open if anybody is trying at all. And so anyway, that all was going on in terms of the gameplay. So already I felt it was a worse game than what they put on the floor, even though the score didn't end up as bad. Then late in the second half, UCLA is down by 25. Michigan State gets a steal, and they are racing down the floor for a breakaway dunk. Steven Jamerson is trailing the play. Notably, Steven Jamerson is one of like maybe two or three Bruins who is trying in this game, who's like actually playing hard and trying. It should be like, you know, he should be getting kudos for playing hard at this point. He's trailing the play, and he goes for the chase down block. Now, Steven Jamerson is not LeBron James. He is not that level of athlete. So the reality is, him going for a chase down block, it's going to be a foul. Like, he's going to hit the guy in the head or hit him in the arm or whatever, and it's going to be a foul. But he's chasing the play, and he's going after the ball. Now, incidentally, while attempting to block it, but, you know, again, he's not that level of athlete, he hits arm, and the guy, I mean, should he have had his legs taken out from under him on that play? I don't know. He
bumps body.
It bumped bodies to an extent. It's not, my point is, it's not a dirty play. Like, there are dirty versions of this play where you're full on taking out the guy's legs, or you're grabbing him around the shoulders,
or removing his head.
Removing his head. Like, there's all this stuff that we've seen before that are dirty versions of this play.
Swiping down, like waving down
with one hand. Like, it is, this is a basketball play.
Yeah.
The guy falls hard. He gets up. He gets in Steven's face. Steven doesn't back down. All of this is above board at this point. This
but Jamerson doesn't say anything. He just stands there. Yeah.
All of this is above board at this point. This is a basketball play. There was an adverse reaction. I think if anybody had walked away from that, they review it and they say flagrant one. I think we all might say, kind of a common foul, but okay, fine.
I would say only flagrant run. I think it was a clean foul. The only thing is that when you're on a break and you're in the air and you hit someone really hard, it probably gets you a flagrant run, just a flagrant one, just on that basis at all, alone. But yeah, correct. Let's just say that.
But a flagrant one doesn't mean a dirty play. Just like it means, you know, excessive contact or whatever the hell.
It doesn't get you thrown out of a game.
No. What gets you thrown out of a game is Mick Cronin, before it was even upgraded to a flagrant one, he pulls Jamerson off the floor and then physically grabs his jersey, gestures to Dave Andrews to get him to the locker room.
The strength and conditioning.
And points, you know, toward the locker room. And then there was a curse word somewhere in there too, but clearly very angry, like very angry, and does a thing that I've talked to like multiple ex-college athletes since then. I've obviously referenced my own memory. Never seen that before. Not in a million years have I seen that. And
there are
plenty of media
people who have said they've never seen it before.
And I've seen guys do things far dirtier than Jamerson. I've seen guys do far dirtier things on UCLA under Mick Cronin.
Yeah, yeah.
Who have not been thrown off the court. This was absolutely bizarre behavior. But and most importantly, it was something that was beyond the impression of the refs. Like, this was a thing where you were doing this. It wasn't like he chokeslammed a guy. So you're doing a thing against your own player. That is beyond anything that was going to be enforced by the rules.
Yeah, because flagrant run, you don't get kicked out. Flagrant two. Exactly. So, but you and I have talked about this, and we know what this was. Mick Cronin is close with Tom Izzo. And this is what so many people have missed. A lot of bros have got it, actually, but like the national media with following this incident, I don't think I've seen anyone who got this. They're friends. They went out to dinner Sunday night, as Mick has made public. In the heat of battle, you know, when Cronin gets his in-game and even slightly after post-game kind of mania going, his reaction in his reverence for Izzo, his knee-jerk reaction was to show deference towards Izzo and kick out Jamerson for that. I believe that if it had been any other game, probably against almost any other coach, Cronin probably would not have done that, sat him down, maybe got in his face a little, but then talked to him later, but wouldn't have done that. I think that was singularly a reaction that he was coaching against Izzo and his deference to Izzo.
Also, Tracy, if that had been Tyler Bilodeau who'd made the foul, would he have gotten kicked out of the game?
That's another point. That's something to speculate about. I know you're going to say probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
No, I think it was a confluence of circumstances that all do not shine a very nice light on Mick Cronin. And I think even if you throw all of that stuff out, my concern, and this is something that's been echoed by a lot of punditry, but I do think it's the most obvious concern if you're worried about this year's team. How does that play if you don't have your guys back in a game in a hostile road environment where he's coming back to Michigan State and you do something to him that is so out there, like so beyond whatever happens in a game? Like, this isn't old school tough love coaching. This is bizarre. This is not something that Tom Izzo had never seen it before. Losing the locker room, like the idea of like, well, if you don't have your guys back, why should they play hard for you? That's an open question now for me, because the public embarrassment for Steven Jamerson being like, he's going to be that note for people. Oh yeah. I've seen a coach throw out his own guy. It was Steven Jamerson at UCLA.
And for Jamerson to return to Michigan State, where he was a regular student, he tried to walk on, and just to come back to be able to play there was kind of a full circle, you know, closure thing for him. So you could see the kid. It was painful to watch him, that he was embarrassed, you know, publicly in that place and on national television. I think Cronin obviously has talked about his players in post-game interviews. From my impression, from what I know of the being kind of close to the program, most of the players, I don't think they necessarily like it, but they understand it when he does that, because he's trying to motivate them to play hard. But they feel in the long run, I've heard this from many players and from families, they really believe Cronin is a coach that will have their back and has and does a lot of things off the court that shows he's very supportive of his players. So I think his first impulse usually would have been to have his players back, but in this unusual situation for him and in that heat of mania, he didn't.
But the thing is, it's not even that you're not having your players back and you might throw them under the bus in the post game, because that happens. And I think everyone accepts that as like, oh, okay, that's just kind of the stuff that happens. Because you maybe see it as motivation and all that kind of stuff. This is such a unique thing he did. Like, it is not, it's not like on that binary of having your players back or not having your players back. It is doing something like proactive to embarrass. Like, it's something excessive beyond the like normal run of the course of like, if he had said after the game, pulling him off the court, sitting him on the bench, and then he'd say after the game, I thought that was an insanely dirty play. I don't support that at all. That's not having your players back, but it's doing it in the normal run of the course of coaching, right? Like that's the way you don't have your players back if they do something you don't like. This was, I don't have my players back, and I'm going to like stand with the crowd in shaming him for his behavior. That's crazy. Like that is not, I don't have, there's, I mean, we're saying the same thing, but I don't, there's no justification for that.
I'm not trying to justify. I'm just maybe trying to explain it a little. I think there are a lot of issues for any coach of when we're 7 years in, we start to learn a lot about a coach, his warts, his positives. I'd say one of the main things with Mick Cronin, and a lot of times it's the elephant in the room, but he gets into that in-game mania where what he's and the chemical in the brain lasts for a good 20 minutes after the game too.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to the other thing yet.
Yeah, so that is what is really the regrettable part about Mick Cronin's tenure, is just and at practice. I think I'm just going to say this now. I think he's a very good coach. I think he's a good person. I think he's a very smart person, and I think he does care about his players and cares about people around the program, unlike a lot of the other coaches in UCLA's history. But there is something about the highly competitive chemicals that turn on in his brain that alter, that affect his judgment, I'd say.
Yeah. Greek crab and claw.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened, so after the game, again, 82-59, he's doing his media scrum. And if you've been around a while, it's 50-50 after a loss, whether he says something or does something that's like, oh gosh. And you know, most of the time, again, it's within the 50% higher or 50% lower than like what you would expect from like Coach A. And it's not, it's like, oh, that was kind of funny, or, oh gosh, probably shouldn't have said that, but it's not, bizarre. This was bizarre. So a Michigan State reporter asks him something about the crowd, whatever. Your mileage may vary on the question. I thought it was fine, but like, whatever. He was trying to get at, I could tell what he was trying to get at. It was just like, I want to have an angle into Xavier Booker's return to Michigan State. So I want to ask about the crowd chanting for him. What did you think of that? That whole thing. Mick cuts him off and says, I don't give a rat's ass about the crowd. And then says, that's the worst question I've ever been asked. Now, here's the thing, Tracy, if he says that to you or me or Ben Bolch or like somebody who covers the team, we might be a little annoyed, but we would take that, I think, in relatively good humor. He said stuff like that to us before. Like, I think he said to you recently, I'm going to, out of the great respect I have for you, I'm going to answer that question as best I can, but I don't even know what the hell you were asking. Something like that. Mm-hmm. He does that stuff. I mean, he's done it to, I think, literally everyone on the beat at different points. And it's one thing if you know a person. He doesn't know this guy. And so he's telling him, your question's horrible and that whole thing. And it's like, okay, that's still within the realm, but that's getting to the top tier of like, this is a little bit strange. Then the guy's like, oh, wow, okay, I'll take that. And Cronin's like, yeah, you will. And at that point, if it dies right there, it's just at the upper range of like the normal, I guess, would say. But then he goes to answer, I think it was Ben's question, but then comes back to that guy, starts talking even more about the question. And then the guy, I think, feeling like a little bit like, well, I don't want this to continue, gets a little higher pitched, But if you, I mean, I don't want to get into like prosodic analysis, but he gets a little higher pitched, but it is in a defensive, diffusing posture. Like, this is not somebody getting angry with Mick. And Mick goes at him and says, are you raising your voice to me? Which I guess like tonally he was, but not in the way anybody would understand raising your voice to be, which is getting angry. The guy was not sounding angry in any way and was in fact sounding a little sheepish and like trying to explain himself. And then it turns into this weird little tete-a-tete where he's like, yes, you were. No, I wasn't. And it gets very, very strange. And it was just, and then Mick says something, which is, this is all on camera, dude. But I think him, again, still being in that like mania state post game, doesn't understand that the camera is not going to be kind to him in this situation. Like he has a distorted impression of what's going on in real life right then.
Distorted, which, altered. That's, yeah.
And
that's,
it's just,
that's
like
the mindset.
This is not good. That's not good to be in that sort of mindset at any point when you have to be in public as part of your job. Yeah. That was because anybody watching that video will say, okay, maybe he specifically raised his voice, but it wasn't in anything like an angry way or anything like a way that you would even comment on. It was a raising voice because we are in a conversation and I am adopting the posture of somebody who is trying to diffuse the situation.
Yeah. And it comes back to what I said. He loses his ability to make accurate judgments. And that, like you said, interpreting the that guy as raising his voice it wasn't accurate for us who were watching on video. So it's the question is now, we've seen Cronin do some things in the past in that have mostly stemmed from this manic state. I would say that they probably rival some of the things that happened in the Michigan State game, but this has become a flashpoint now. It is getting national attention. Mm-hmm. It really blew up. It's the kind of thing that draws attention to your program and your coach and not in a good way. And, you know, Dave and I have been doing this a long time. And it's funny because you try to, and it's hard to try to anticipate what the zeitgeist, what the environment and landscape will be five games from now, or in football, you know, at the end of the season. You can kind of feel it. And Dave and I have probably got pretty good at anticipating where it could go. It's always, you know, it's always a chance it will go that way or that a certain way. But because of that flashpoint from that game, and you know what? I think it needed both of those things, Dave. It needed both the Jamerson thing and both the interview afterward for it to get to get to the height that it has received. There is a possibility that we're thinking by the end of this season, it could be a situation that we've experienced with coaches before where, how would you call a situation, Dave, at the end of the, it just gets to a point where it's intolerable, untenable. It goes beyond,
hey, you're playing the line.
What's that?
Yeah, at some point you're playing out the string and it's not, it's already over.
We're not saying that's the case now, but we're saying having been here and seen this, it feels like it could be going that on there's the a chance it could be going. It's on the cusp. We'll
on the cusp. I would say, so Luke, obviously what happened at Michigan State has created a national stir. And I think it was a combination of not much else going on in the world of like American sports. I mean, obviously the Olympics are going on, but there wasn't a whole lot else going on Tuesday night. And so I think a lot of people, it was like their 1A item the next morning because it was kind of nuts. And it was something that was unique. And it's not the kind of light you want shown on UCLA, particularly in the midst of what has already been a disappointing basketball season. And as I wrote yesterday, it's the third straight disappointing men's basketball season. 2 years ago, they missed the tournament. Last year, put together a roster with a good amount of NIL and produced a team that was a 7 seed and made it to the second round of the tournament. This year, they look like they're firmly on the bubble and could fall off if they collapse down the stretch here. So there are, it's 3 seasons in a row that do not meet the standard of what UCLA wants in a men's basketball program. And then you add to that by putting a little grace note at the end of the season of like two different in the same game or the same game day, two different incidents that are both weird and embarrassing and both caused largely by the head coach. And that's stuff that like, that's not good, but it's not the whole picture. 'Cause the whole picture is you've got to think, when you're making a decision about whether or not to retain a head coach, it's a complicated calculus, but fundamentally it's, is this guy still viable? Meaning, can he produce another good team or not? And two, how much is it going to cost to make a change? And those are really the two fundamental things. I mean, personal loyalty does not get into it when you're making million-dollar decisions, or it shouldn't. It really comes down to two things. Can this guy still win? And how much is it going to cost if we do change? And really, the first question is the most important one for reasons we'll get into. But so Mick Cronin, is he still viable? That's the first question. And if you look at what he's produced the last 3 years, it's an open question. And, you know, Tracy, like NIL, from what we know, it's going to be good, but it's not going to be top 10. It's not going to be the elite of the elite. Can he show he can evaluate and produce a roster that can compete in the Big Ten while also, look, the stuff yesterday or the stuff on Tuesday could have an impact on whether or not you're able to bring in high profile transfers? Because if you're the next Donovan Dent or the next, whatever you want to call him, whoever, for the next Tyler Bilodeau, how much extra are you charging to go play for Mick Cronin in UCLA after he's a guy who, you know, threw his own player out of a game for the first time in anyone's, you know, recorded memory?
Can he do it? Yes, he can do it. Did the path get considerably narrower? Yes. And is it narrowing? Probably still is. As this keeps resonating out there, the path is probably getting narrower. So in your, like what we're saying with your first point, you're going to go out in Mick Cronin's the coach. Let's say after April 1st, he's going to go into the transfer portal, which opens the Monday after the NCAA championship game. He'll go into the transfer portal. And I think it's safe to assume that it's the talent pool and transfer portal is going to get a little bit shallower for the UCLA program, and it will cost them more. There will be a premium. So there is that. Just to get in the room, I'd say. And then you cannot probably miss on your eval. If you bring in six guys of transfers, you got to nail five, let's say. So your evaluations have to be 100% spot on. And that's not even just the guy's talented enough. The guy plays with the toughness that can play for Cronin. He has an indication that he'll buy in. He'll play defense. I've been banging this drum. If Mick Cronin is going to recruit the transfer portal, you got to go out and find a team of defenders. Athletic defenders, because that's the type of guy that creates the team that Mick Cronin can win with. And those guys are almost always naturally tough, play hard, buy in, because you have to be if you're a good defender. So it's good evaluations. They go see a shiny object of some guy who scores 18 points a game and can shoot and can really shoot and fill it up, and he can't defend and he's not athletic. You better have five other guys who could defend that you bring in. And I don't even know if you should have him, because he's going to be that shiny object on the bench that Cronin just has to play because he needs that basket. So it's all about evaluations too. And let's just be straight. The evaluations with the transfer portal haven't been fantastic.
They've been poor. Yeah. I would say there's two things that have been poor, and your mileage may vary again on which one you think is worse, but I don't think either have been good. The evaluations of existing personnel and the evaluations of transfer portal personnel, and how it all fits together. I would highlight three existing personnel evaluations that have caused major issues over the last 3 years. One, Dylan Andrews. Two, Adai Mara. And three, Eric Daly, where those have caused issues because there was a misevaluation of what a player is capable of or what he is not capable of. Then the reality smacked him right in the face very quickly. And roster construction was built around each of these guys being something or not something, because they built a roster not accounting for Adai Mara, and then Adai Mara emerged and they showed an unwillingness to adjust to the reality that Adai Mara had become the most indispensable player on the team. Dylan Andrews, they built a roster around him being the starting point guard, and then he was unable to perform the duties of a starting point guard. They built a roster with the idea that Eric Daly could play the three, which he cannot do, and was never going to be capable of doing, not in any reality where full physical surgery isn't possible. Like, he would have needed to completely change his muscle fibers to play the three. And that's not a thing that can happen in real life. It would take something out of science fiction for Eric Daly to play the three. So those things in terms of evaluating your own roster, what potential mistakes could be made? It's hard to even quantify. It's hard to even notice what those could be at this point. And then there's the what Tracy's getting at, which is, okay, you're going to have to nail evaluations. That doesn't mean go get the best players in the portal. It means go get the best fits for what Mick Cronin is good at. What Mick Cronin is good at is coaching defense and coaching responsible offensive play. That's it. Those are his two strengths. Those are his core values. Now, I'm not sure he's aware of that, because he keeps going after shooters. And the thing is, if you're good at coaching defense, what you want are people who are capable of playing defense, because then you can take guys who are capable of playing defense and turn them into super defenders. So to Tracy's point, you want to go get athletes. You want to go get guys who can really play defense. And then you're going to teach them not to turn the ball over, and eventually you're going to make a shot. But what we've seen over the last 3-4 years is when they go into the portal or when they go into high school recruiting, they're going after scorers. They're going after guys who can shoot, guys who can score, those sorts of things. And look, I'm speaking to the people out there, your impression of basketball may be that you want those guys. I get it. I understand. I like watching scoring too. But Mick Cronin's style of basketball is predicated on defense. Whatever you want him to be, that's the reality. He needs to know that. You need to know that. And that needs to be the approach to the transfer portal. Needs to be the approach to roster building. And it hasn't been. So when we're talking about viability, what we're saying is, yes, they just need to use their good but not great NIL to go out, evaluate the market, and get some guys who are a good fit for Mick Cronin, and then they'll produce on the floor. But we haven't seen any evidence that that is the approach of Mick Cronin. Over and over, he's taking guys who are not fits for his system, who are not fits for what he is good at. And it's just the part where you have to nail the evaluations is the elephant in the room. That's the part where it's like, if you're questioning viability, it's like you're kind of just hoping that it will work out. There isn't evidence to point to that he's going to suddenly nail these evaluations.
And then we touched on how there will be a premium on NIL for transfers, and it's just not for transfers. And this is just purely me speculating. A player like Trent Perry, who you'd think would be a cornerstone that they would want to retain for next season, you'd have to think he's had a breakout season.
Monster month and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. He absolutely will go test the waters, not of the NBA draft, but of
he's going to make a
NIL
lot of money.
Place. He could make a lot of money. And whether he wants to stay in a complete rebuild, given the state of the program right now and what we just said, the status of Mick Cronin, how much does that cost in terms of NIL for him to stay? How much more of a premium? So if we're talking, we talk about the narrow pathway. So I think, first step, Cronin needs to get the team to buy in for the rest of the season, more or less. There might be games where they don't play hard.
They have to play hard the last five games.
You have to salvage the season to some degree of respectability. I mean, it can't end on a real downward note. If it does, there have been those flashpoints like what we saw against Michigan State that I think combine for too much of a whole environment for possibly Mick Cronin being let go. So he's got to do that. Then, as we said, you have to nail the transfer evaluations, and then you have to be prepared and have the NIL money to pay a premium for your existing players and for your transfers. So he's threading a needle here. I think he can do it, but that's what's ahead of him. So much is being made about the buyout, and it should be. I mean, the buyout isn't nothing. It's on April 1st, it turns into $18 million. And let's just clarify this. It's 21.8 or something before April 1st. But if you would let commonly, if you're going to fire someone, you tell them ahead of time, hey, we're going to let you go, but we're going to make it official on April 1st. So we're going to pay you. They're not going to do it.
Clarification.
Yeah.
The buyout is a moving target because there isn't really a buyout. The contract is fully guaranteed. He's being paid right now. He's being paid his salary. So the buyout right now, if you fired him right now, is $18 million plus what remains season on this first year of his contract. There isn't a point where it goes from like a cliff and it goes from 22 to 18. Right. It's right now 18.75 or something like that.
Right.
So and let's then on just, April 1st.
Right. So let's just establish that first off. If we're going to argue about whether UCLA screwed the pooch on, yeah, we can talk about that all day, but here's the thing. If it's determined that, like what we said about getting the team to buy in, getting the team to play a little bit better towards the end of the season, if that doesn't happen and it's pretty miserable at the end of the season, it doesn't matter what the buyout is. UCLA put that in, that buyout, wherever the contract, the terms of the contract, because it is an ongoing effort to make your program and your coaching position look like it's one of the best in the country. UCLA has to do that. That's what programs do. That's why we see these stupid, ridiculous buyouts in football and basketball, because programs are trying to make, athletic departments are trying to make their program look like it's elite and it's competing at the highest level. You know, it sends a message to a coach. This is how much money you're going to make, and this is how much money you're going to make even if you're fired. I mean, that's what they have to do to keep pace. So if this is what you've established and you've determined that these are the terms of the contract, but you then determine it's not viable to go forward, UCLA has no choice but to put on its big boy pants and pay the terms of the contract it established so that it can play big boy college basketball.
Yeah, and here's the thing with the buyout, and just again, because the contract is fully guaranteed, yeah, you look at that and you say, gosh, well, that was a misstep and whatever. As Tracy pointed out, I do think there are reasons why you do this, but like your mileage may vary. And again, that's totally fine. I don't, whatever. But the cool thing about a fully guaranteed contract is it actually doesn't matter when you fire the guy, because no matter what, you are paying that thing out, right?
Yeah.
So if you fired him tomorrow, you're paying out an additional $18.7 million or whatever.
And the little bit that's left on his contract from this year.
Yes. Yeah. Or to next year at this time, you know what you're doing? You're paying him $4.5 million between this time this year and this time next year. And then you're paying him the remainder of his contract.
Yeah.
At no point are you getting out of paying him the remainder of his contract. And so it doesn't matter if you're firing him today or tomorrow. The only reason to keep him on and to keep this going, if you determine that he is non-viable, is you want to get an additional year distant and an additional year of not having to pay for the new coach. Because that's the thing. At some point, there are going to be startup costs with a new coach where you have to pay a salary. You got to pay for a front office staff. You got to invest in NIL to a level probably that you're higher than right now. It's going to be a big price tag, huge price tag when you hire the new coach. But that price tag happens no matter what. It's going to happen at some point. Unless Mick Cronin completely arrests the slide and somehow reclaims where he was 5 years ago or 4 years ago, wherever it was. That's the only way that they're not doing this in the next couple of years. So yeah. It's really just, at what point do you want to take that hit on your ledger? Is it this year? Is it next year? Is it the year after? But at some point, the bills come and do. I mean,
yeah, and the thing is, now I'll get into it a little. They established this extension and it was for more money every year, right? The contract went from 4.5 to I don't know what it went to. As you said, it's built into the contract. So the difference is if you hire a new coach, of course, you've got that little overlap that you've got the new coach and you're still paying your old coach. But the difference is really you were committed to a contract. You were committed. You were going to pay that contract out anyway. And it's the difference between what you were going to pay, what you had paid him, and now what you're paying him. You're paying him this amount. You're not getting out from under it. This is the reality of it. And it comes back to if UCLA wants, if it's going to talk the talk of playing big boy college basketball, this is walking the walk. If it determines this, the factor of what the contract stipulates as what a buyout is shouldn't matter. They should make that move based on all these other factors that we're talking about. And just when we're talking about buyout, just to put this in perspective, in the we kind of rendered the buyout kind of moot. Right now, Kansas State is trying to get out of its contract with its coach, Jerome Tang, for cause. And, you know, I just want to touch on this. A lot of UCLA fans on the board are saying, can we do this for – you can't – Kansas State is attempting this, and it's getting ugly already. And they haven't even gone to court. Tang's attorneys have said, oh, you think that's embarrassing? You wait on how much we're going to make this embarrassing for you. I looked up what his buyout is, and it's $18.7 million at Kansas State. He's been in, I think he's in his fourth year. So we're in the comparable realm of what would be, and I'm air quoting, a buyout. So it's really not about that. It's whether UCLA decides to play big boy college basketball, and you do not want to get in to fire for cause. You'd have to, oh my God, it'd be so messy. It'd be long and drawn out. Lawyers would be involved, and you've got to kind of prove that he violated his contract. Like, they're trying to prove that Tang said some things, and I think it was in a press conference, that his players don't play hard, his players don't take responsibility, all this stuff. And they're trying to say that those were violated his contract. This is nothing to get involved with.
It's so not
let's just throw out that whole thing about firing anyone for cause.
So the thing is, like, generally, good general rule from what I know from like actual employment lawyers is, unless you actually have cause, and we all know what cause is. Like, cause is like you abused somebody, like you beat somebody up, or you did something weird and sexual to somebody, or like,
and you have it chronicled. You have
documentation. You don't have cause. It's not the way this works, because the thing is, anything you would point to as cause for what like Mick Cronin did yesterday or on Tuesday, for example, he has had tirades after games before. He has embarrassed players on the floor before. He has criticized guys before. He's been angry in games before. He has cursed at players before. All of that is documented and has been documented for years. But what Cronin's lawyers would definitely say is, at no point did this become an issue for cause until I started losing games. So this is a performance firing, not a cause firing. Because that's what it... Look, guys... Let's be real and honest with yourselves right now. First, if they were winning games right now, Mick Cronin wouldn't be doing this. Second, if they were winning games right now and he was doing this, very few people would be complaining. Let's be honest. Okay. And it's just, look, I've been uncomfortable with his coaching style since, I think, honestly, the first time I saw it in person was Maui in 2023 or whatever it was. And I was like, wow, that's because I saw it during a timeout when the TV cameras were not on, and it was not a good look. I don't think anger is a great way of teaching people. I really don't. But nobody's been banging a drum that there've been a few people on our message board until things got bad, until they've started to lose games. So, it's a performance firing if it comes, and if it's a performance firing, you can try to mitigate certain points of the contract language and say, hey, instead of paying you out monthly over the next 4 years, here's what we'll do. We'll give you a lump sum of X. But that lump sum is going to be a lot of money, guys. It just is. It's a fully guaranteed contract. And like I don't think UCLA is going to want to get into the weeds of like a process of figuring out whether or not this is for cause. I don't think it makes sense for them. I don't think it makes sense when you're trying to go hire new coaches if you try to go after a guy who is respected in the coaching community. Like, it's not a good idea.
He's well-respected and well-liked in the coaching community.
And we're not BSing. Mick, when he's not in the in-game and the, again, 20 minutes after game or sometimes in practice, pretty good guy. Like, you know, good to deal with. You know, heard a lot of good things about like stuff he's done for various people. Like, he's not unpopular with a lot of people. It's just not a good idea for UCLA to get into that at all.
Like I said, UCLA is in the business, as is every athletic department, to present their program and their head coaching job as something that is attractive. That's why you do extensions. That's why you do big buyouts. That's why you hire a front office. This is to be appealing towards potentially the rest of the industry out there. You have to look at it through that prism. You can't do anything really that's going to diminish that. You just can't. And I mean, trying to come up with some for cause suit is not going to do it. Another thing too, and we've got some pushback on the forum about this, pulling NIL donations is contrary to that also.
Yeah, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, you want to be, if you want to show up, if you don't want to show up at a game and show that that's
the best protest, way to show that you're upset is to
put a bag on your head. Show up to the game, put a bag on your head. Do that. Pick it. Write the chancellor an email. Do all that stuff. Pulling your NIL donation, this is what it does. If perchance UCLA does have to find a new coach, his second question, maybe the first question is how expensive is real estate? His second question is,
how much do I have?
How much do I have of NIL? And if it's not competitive and he finds out it's dropped over the last month because of the previous coach, he is going to balk. He doesn't want to hear that. He wants to hear a good number first off, and then he wants to minimize the amount of work it's going to take to bring the NIL up to where, to what he wants. It's counterproductive. It does not send a message to UCLA. It only undercuts the coaching position as a whole, and because all they care about is getting talent. The coach cares about getting talent into the program. So do other things. I don't do this. I know it seems like the natural thing to do. Let's not support the program. I'll pull my NIL, but that's not the way this works.
Yeah. I think, look, people are going to do with their money what they want to do with their money. It's just, it's not, I get the impulse, which is if I'm not a season ticket holder, if I'm not somebody who goes to games, this is the way that I can signal my displeasure. But I'll be honest with you, from the dynamic standpoint, if you're giving through the bro campaign, I'm the only one who knows. Like I get the email notifications. That's pretty much it. Like, so all you're doing is signaling to David Woods that you're unhappy. And you know how you can signal that, guys? Just post it on our message board. Honestly, and again, another method of signaling your displeasure that will be noticed is if you are posting on our message board. Like, I don't mean to like be too self-aggrandizing, but it gets noticed. If the tenor on our board is entirely negative, that gets noticed. I'm not advocating that we want our board to look like a negative cesspool, but like the many posts over the last couple of days, like it's part and parcel of the like the broader narrative. And so like there are plenty of ways I think to signal your displeasure. But I mean, it's, again, it's not like, I mean, the majority of people, what we're talking about is like $25 to $50 a month, which again, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a ton of money, but like when that becomes a mass movement, it's just, it's going to diminish the job in various ways. And is that an unfortunate reality of the system that we are currently existing in for player acquisition? Yes, it sucks. I understand that, but it is the system right now. And it is part of the conversation when you are trying to attract a new coach. And you know, the more united front that UCLA can present when they are eventually going to the market for a new basketball coach, and that in terms of like the fan base, the administration, the NIL donors and boosters, the better. So do with your money what you will. I would just say it's not, I don't think, productive for what you're attempting. For if you are pulling your money because you want Mick Cronin fired, it's not the best way. The best way is by signaling your displeasure in ways that will be noticed by somebody besides, again, me checking my email, which is with not going to games, with signaling your displeasure on Twitter, on the message board, with emails. But again, I would advise if you're going to email, make them polite. Make sure they're not vitriolic. Make sure they're well-reasoned too. I mean, a well-written good email can do wonders, but come on, don't say, hey, you know, F this guy. I'm never going to a game again. I hate this. You know, don't do that. But if you want to say, hey, look, I've been a season ticket holder for X and I'm thinking about not renewing because this is not a product that I want to watch anymore, that's meaningful. So, you know, just use your best judgment, but I get it. But I don't think pulling donations is going to, or pulling donations to NIL. You know, you can make your Wooden Athletic Fund decisions for yourself. Pulling donations to NIL, I don't think it's going to have the impact you think it does.
I'd probably like to end on, you know, there's discussions on the forum about past UCLA coaches in football and basketball. And I'd like to put like Mick Cronin kind of in that discussion of our experience with the coaches that have been at UCLA. Everyone knows I have a personal relationship with Mick. And like Dave said, off the court, I know him to be a very good person. I know what he's done for people around him. I know what he's done for Pat, for his former players. I've seen him in certain situations that has shown his character. I think he's a very good coach. I think he knows basketball. If you spend time with him and listen to him talk about basketball, it certainly is it's uncanny. And I think he's a very good coach. I think this whole situation of where it's gone is really regrettable. And I think Dave makes a really, really, really good point. If he were winning, Mick Cronin has flaws. Everyone has flaws. Mick Cronin would admit he has flaws. Everyone close to him would admit he's human. But if he were winning, the flaws would be overlooked. Because there's enough there beyond just the winning. There's enough also to offset some of the flaws with his character, with the fact that he's a good coach. And the fact, too, that he legitimately cares about UCLA and does care about the program and its reputation. So, I mean, I'm not trying to make a point specifically anything about, like, you know, that Mick Cronin doesn't deserve this. Where we are right now is mostly his own doing. But I just want to create some nuance and flesh it out a little that on who Mick Cronin is and what he's done at UCLA, just to put it all in perspective. Comparatively to other coaches, he ranks right up there for just the entire job that he's done at UCLA. I mean, really simply, he understood NIL. He works, you know, donors to try to build NIL when the guy across campus decided he was going to ignore NIL. I mean, there's so many parts of the job that Mick does because he knows he has to do it to win. Or he wants to do it to be, you know, the right kind of person. He has flaws and it's caused some of these issues, but I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, no, I think that's all fair. So, anyway, I think some depends on these next five games. We'll see how this goes. If they can somehow rally, I do think that will calm the waters a little bit. If the collapse continues, you know, if they get smoked by Illinois on Saturday and then, you know, finish no better than 2-2 down the stretch, then I think there's going to be some hard conversations after the season. I don't think this is the kind of thing, like, people, I think some people are out for blood and they think it's going to happen like right now. And I mean, Stephen A. Smith talking about this on First Take is not going to get Mick Cronin fired later that afternoon. It's not. But you know, I do think the way that weekend went, with everything, the losses plus, you know, the issues, I do think it's opened that door and I don't think anyone was prepared for that door to open this season. But I do think that door is now open. And if things go really south over the last five games, you know, kind of continuing on where they were this weekend, then I do think, like, going into the end of the season, it's going to be an open question whether he's going to return in the following year. Yeah, it's very strange that this happened, because I think, you know, going back to that extension for just a second, yes, all the reasons for the extension I do think are valid. Like, and I get people who are saying, why would you give that guy $18 million or $22 million? I get it. I get it. Why wouldn't you make it like a 75% buyout? Okay, I get it. But I don't think there's any world where UCLA gives out that extension expecting that they might have to make a decision to fire him after the following season. I don't think that was on the radar. And honestly, it wasn't on my radar either. And I'm usually pretty attuned to this stuff. I was thinking, you know, it's at the like low end side of the spectrum, it was 2 years. I was not thinking after this year that it would be happening. So, I don't think they would have given that out if they thought this was, you know, potential for this season. So I think it is something that's kind of just happened, beyond what people were initially expecting. So anyway, is there anything else we want to talk about before we get going?
No, I think that was good. I think we did right by this subject matter.
I think we did. I think we crushed it. Okay. Well, all right. Illinois game in 2 days. I think that's going to be a significant one, obviously. They just absolutely smoked USC off the floor in the Galen Center. UCLA will have a very, very, very tough matchup.
Yeah. We're talking about, we touched on what UCLA would have to do to end respectably. That would probably...
You can't get smeared off.
Include beating Illinois.
Well, you can't get smeared. Like, you have to be, it has to be at minimum a competitive game.
Yeah.
So, if that is competitive, then, you know, that would obviously stem the tide a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. Dave. For Tracy Pearson, I'm David Woods, Bruin Report Online, and we will talk to you again next time.
See you at Pauly.